You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, two friends make the case for making more time and space for friendship in your life, even if it has to be long distance. Now, we got a question from a listener earlier this year about Camp Randall Stadium, the Badger football home stadium with a long history. Our listener asked about the history of Camp Randall going back before there even was such a thing as college football being played. Here's listener John Hansen.
Hi, I'm John from Madison, and I have a question for Wisconsin. I would like to know more about early Camp Randall history at the UW as a Civil War troops training ground, the person it was named after, Governor Randall, and any other interesting history events up to its modern version. Thanks. Go Bucky.
To help answer John's question, we called up Daniel Einstein. Daniel is the UW-Madison Historic and Cultural Resources Manager. Daniel, welcome to Central Time.
Good to be here.
Before we get into the history lesson, the phrase Camp Randall could get a little confusing. I think people think of the stadium, but it actually refers to a lot of different things all in the same general area. Sort that out for us a little, please.
Well, why don't I just start by saying that all cultural landscape stories really begin with the indigenous people who occupied this area since 12,000 years ago after the retreat of the last glacier. And I just want to acknowledge that when Europeans migrated to this area in the early 1800s, the Ho-Chunk people were well established here. But to your question about the names of all the Camp Randall structures and properties, it was in 1861 that the federal government called upon the states to muster soldiers for the Civil War. And at the time, the governor was Alexander Randall. And he identified the former state agriculture society fairgrounds as a place for a military training camp. And that's how the name of the 53-acre Camp Randall training ground was first established. And for those of you who are familiar with Madison, that 53-acre plot extends from Breeze Terrace to University Avenue to Randall Avenue to Monroe Street. So a pretty big chunk of what is now the UW-Madison campus. There are several place names that reference Camp Randall. There's Camp Randall Memorial Park, which is that green space adjacent to what we refer to as the shell. There is the arch, which is the Camp Randall Memorial Arch. And then, of course, there's Camp Randall Stadium, which folks have come to use the more informal reference of Camp Randall, but it's really Camp Randall Stadium.
Well, let's get into our little listener's question a little more. You referenced the creation of Camp Randall, this 50-plus acre Civil War Union soldier training ground. Talk us through the history of that site, what happened there over the course of the war.
So Camp Randall is a military training ground, lasted for 4 years from 1861 to the end of the war in 1865. Over 70,000 Wisconsin troops moved through the camp, sometimes as many as 5,000 people at a time. And that was fully three quarters of all the soldiers that Wisconsin provided to the Union Army. So a really significant military establishment here in Madison. By the end of the war, there were 40 barracks, a hospital, officer quarters, stables, a commissary, everything that you can imagine would be necessary to support up to 5,000 people at a time. One of the stories that is particularly interesting to Camp Randall is the period in 1862 when 1,200 prisoners of war, Confederate soldiers, were brought to Madison and were housed at Camp Randall. And during that period of just over a month, it wasn't very long at all, 140 of the soldiers died, mostly from disease and wounds prior to their capture. And those soldiers were buried in Forest Hill Cemetery, just here on the west side of Madison. That created the northernmost Confederate burial ground in the country. At the end of the war, the property reverted to a state agricultural fairground, and eventually the state of Wisconsin purchased it in 1893.
And as the agricultural fairground, if I understand correctly, we had state fairs on that site at a few points in history.
Right. Actually, before the war and after the war, there were state fairs, as well as other major public events like the circus. So the property that became the training ground served many functions, including just agricultural functions as a pasture. And for a while, in the early 1890s, the property was used as one of the first pharmaceutical gardens for doing research on medicinal plants. And so it's interesting to note that back in the early 1890s, the university was doing research on a plant called cannabis, looking at the early medicinal values of that plant.
Talking to Daniel Einstein, UW-Madison's Historic and Cultural Resources Manager, and answering one of your Why Wisconsin questions about the history of Camp Randall, the stadium and the historic site, including the Civil War training ground that is in that part of Madison. Now, Daniel, you mentioned the Memorial Arch. Can you talk about efforts after the Civil War, in some cases well after the Civil War, to memorialize the Union Army soldiers who trained there?
Sure. So as I mentioned, it was 1893. It was 28 years after the end of the Civil War, and the property was being considered for residential development. And the veterans approached the state and said that wouldn't be right to convert these hallowed grounds, this place where so many Union soldiers were both mustered in and left military service. And so they convinced the state to purchase the property, and it was given to the university for their use, for their exclusive use. And the university built the first building on the old training ground in 1909, a forest products lab. So the first rendition of the forest products lab was right there on University Avenue. It's now called the Materials Sciences Building. And in 1895, the first football game was played on the field next to the agricultural fairgrounds grandstand. So this was a field that dated to exhibitions during the fair period. And that would have been located where Engineering Hall is right now. That was 1895 was the first football game in what we now refer to as the former Camp Randall training ground.
And better not let you go, Daniel, without finding out when something like the modern stadium ended up being there for football.
Sure. So the old grandstand had problems. The bleachers collapsed, and in 1917, the money was allocated to create a new stadium, and the first concrete seating structure was built into the side of Breeze Terrace, that slope on the side of the west side of Camp Randall Stadium. And then subsequently, there were many additions made to the stadium. And now, of course, it can accommodate up to 80,000. But initially, it was just a few concrete bleachers on the side of the Breeze Terrace Hill.
Daniel, thanks so much for sharing this history with us today.
My pleasure.
Daniel Einstein is the UW-Madison Historic and Cultural Resources Manager. We talked with him today about the history of UW-Madison's Camp Randall, including the Civil War training ground and Confederate prison there. This conversation was inspired by a question from listener John Hansen in Madison as part of the Why Sconson Project. Submit your Why Sconson questions. We might answer them in a future story. Go to WPR.org/Why Sconson. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're talking about the history of Camp Randall. We just went back to the Civil War era. Now we'll check out more recent stories from the UW-Madison football stadium. There are traditions like jump around in Bucky's fifth quarter, great moments for the Badgers football team, or maybe just incredible fall and winter days spent outdoors as part of the red and white wave of spectators. And we want to hear from you. What's your favorite Camp Randall stadium memory? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know. Here's one memorable football moment. October 16th, 2010, number one Ohio State came to Camp Randall for a night game.
The first time in 13 years a top-ranked team comes to town. Kick is in the air. Gilreath will have an opportunity. He'll catch at the 3. Between the hash marks, 10. Slicing left, 15. Across the 20. 25-30. Gilreath to the 40. He's to the 50. Foot race to the house. At the 30. At the 20. 10. 5. Touchdown, Wisconsin. And this game is underway with a bang.
That was the voice of Matt LePay, who is the voice of UW-Madison basketball and football. Matt, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. Great to be on with you.
Well, you've seen so many games there. Do you have a first memory, your first encounter with Camp Randall Stadium?
A first or a favorite?
Let's hear both.
My first is kind of a contrast in emotions, I guess, from a fan's perspective, because I grew up in Ohio and I moved here in 1988. And my first game at Camp Randall Stadium, there were about, I think, 36,000 fans in the stands, which meant there were about 40,000 empty seats. They had a very tough year that year. They only won one game, and the first game I went to wasn't one of them. They lost to Western Michigan. So that whole season was a bit of a mess, to put it mildly. The favorite, there are three that stand out. You just played a highlight from one of them, but I think if I was to be asked my single favorite memory, I think for me, and I would imagine a lot of fans would be inclined to agree, would have been in November of 1999, the day that Ron Dane set the NCAA career rushing record. Middle of November, it was about 70 degrees, like it always is, right? The middle of November,
right, yeah.
Here in Madison. And the day was perfect. Wisconsin had clinched another Big Ten championship. The Badgers routed an Iowa team, a rival, a longtime rival, and Ron set the rushing record. If I was to narrow it down to one, that would be the one.
Let's talk about the space here. You've done, obviously, home and away games. You've had a lot of opportunities to compare and contrast. What to you is special about Camp Randall Stadium?
Well, I just think the environment in the stadium and around the stadium, which we obviously cannot have this season for the obvious reasons. But I think just the party atmosphere, the festive atmosphere. Football is very important to people here, but it's also the social aspect of it. I think Badger fans, they take their team seriously, but generally speaking, they know where to draw the line. It isn't win a national championship or bust. It's have a great time, take great pride in your school, in the athletes who represent the university and represent the state of Wisconsin. I think that to me, I think Badger fans have by and large done a great job of separating. You know, it's important to see their team win, but it's not the be all end all. And I think that's the one thing, and jump around and the fifth quarter and everything that goes into it. It's more than just the game, but the fact that the team has been good far more often than not for the last 25 plus years, it certainly added a lot to it. And knowing that in most cases, nearly every seat is going to be full.
Well, and you've gotten to witness what a lot of people in the state have witnessed, the team going from, I don't know, maybe a lovable loser persona for this football team to a consistently team that people have to think about. Even if they're not at the top of the Big Ten, any given year, they could be in contention. Could you talk about that transition?
Yeah, it went from, lovable loser is one way to put it. I think people, the team was in such dire straits there. There's always going to be a certain amount of fan anger, and then it just turned into apathy. People just wouldn't come to the games anymore. And then Barry Alvarez arrived. Donna Shalala, the chancellor, she understood that it's not a bad thing if your football team is really good. And bringing in Pat Richter as the athletics director, a true Badger in every sense of the word, one of the great people that I've ever met in athletics, no matter the level. And then the hiring of Barry Alvarez, who he had the famous line in his introductory press conference, you better get your season tickets now because before long you might not be able to, which seemed like one of the most arrogant statements in the history of college football. But it was the attitude that Wisconsin had to have. You had to have somebody come in here and say, Wisconsin can be a winner. And he did an off the charts great job in elevating the program to the level it has been at now for more than 25 years. And I always tell people that if the worst thing you can say about your favorite team is they have a chance every time that they play, that they at least have a chance, that's a pretty good thing, because there were a number of years here where you really couldn't say that. But the Wisconsin program has been good enough long enough that when in doubt, you still think every time they step on the field, no matter who it's against, that they have a chance.
Talking to Matt LePay, voice of Wisconsin football and basketball, looking at the history of Camp Randall, the stadium, the site, and the team that plays there. And Matt, I got to ask, I grew up listening to Ernie Harwell calling the Detroit Tigers games. Always been a fan of sports broadcasters. Doing live radio, I even more appreciate the job that you guys do. What goes into preparing for any given Saturday, I guess, for you?
Yeah, that's the key word there is preparing, preparation. When I talk to younger broadcasters, I make the loose comparison, you're studying for a test. And the more efficiently, the more effectively you study, the easier the test should be. You want to make it as a broadcaster where the game is fun, because there's a lot of traffic that we have to get in during the course of the game. We have a lot of sponsors. We want to make sure that we give them the recognition that they deserve, and maintain the mechanics of the game, the score, the time, where's the ball, who has the ball, who made the tackle. So it's a lot of memorization. I've been going through the Illinois roster this week. And just talked to my counterpart who calls the Illinois games, talked to him earlier today, just comparing notes. And you get as much background information on the players as you can, keeping up to date all the time with the Badger players, talking to a few players every week, meeting with head coach Paul Christ at least twice a week. So you just gather as much information as you can. So that it should be fun. There's always the unexpected, right? They expect the unexpected, but the better the grasp you have on the material, the Wisconsin roster, the Illinois roster, in theory, the easier and the more enjoyable the broadcast should be.
Is it going to be possible to keep up that fun factor at the game without the fans and the stands going nuts?
Yeah, it's a little different. I have some experience with that now, filling in with the Milwaukee Brewers, their television broadcast, doing a couple of dozen games. It's definitely different. You notice it when you walk in to an empty ballpark or here in empty Camp Randall Stadium. You're not going to have that pregame hype when you're driving into the stadium. There's not going to be game traffic, right? But I think when the game starts, at least in my experience, you're locked in to your job. And in this case, it's describing the game for a radio audience and try to be as detailed as you possibly can. I find it in a lot of ways more awkward to watch or listen to a game without a crowd than it is to actually work a game without a crowd, because you're just occupied with the things that you need to do to execute a broadcast.
Matt, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure. Take care.
Matt LaPay is the voice of Wisconsin football and basketball. We talked with him about some memorable moments in Camp Randall Stadium during an unusual year for college football. Earlier, we talked about some of the Civil War era history of the grounds of Camp Randall. Both of these conversations were inspired by a question from listener John Hansen in Madison as part of the Why Wisconsin project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future story. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Coming up, how much do you invest in the most important friendship in your life? As much as with a spouse or with other close family members? We'll hear from two friends who say that deep friendships take work and they deserve the same level of care. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We know that it can be tough to keep up with the current events in a 24-hour news cycle. Besides daily news coverage, tune into Central Time on Wednesdays for a look at the week in Washington and all week long for conversations about issues that affect Wisconsinites. All that and more here on Central Time, weekdays from 3 to 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, we spend a lot of time investing in our jobs and careers, and we're willing to put a lot of effort in to keep our relationships with significant others going strong. But when it comes to our friendships, we don't always think of it as something that requires so much maintenance. Most of the time, friends are supposed to equal fun. Our next guests say friendships are really important parts of our lives, and they shouldn't have to play second or third fiddle. And we want to hear from you. Is there a friendship that you have maintained over the years? What did it take to keep that going, even during tough times, maybe even long distance? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know. Aminatou Sow and Ann Friedman are two close friends who also host Call Your Girlfriend, a podcast about long-distance friendship. They've written a book sharing lessons, hardships, and their own rough patches in their friendship. It's called Big Friendship, How We Keep Each Other Close. Aminatou, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having us.
And Anne, welcome to the show.
Great to be with you.
Let's talk at first about this concept of big friendship. Aminatou, could you tell us what the two of you mean by that?
Yes, we coined the term big friendship because we really wanted to put a stake in the ground about the kind of relationship that we were talking about. The word friend is so nebulous. It can mean truly anything from someone you haven't seen in 40 years, but you were close to once upon a time, to someone who is close to your life in the everyday today. And so when we talk about a big friendship, we are talking about a friendship that is mature, a friendship that is rooted in the future, a friendship where two people are really invested in being active in building a life together.
And can you talk about the value of making time, space, and effort for those kind of big friendships and not letting it be the thing that we let go of as we focus on the other stuff in our lives?
It's so true. You know, a thing that we heard from experts that we interviewed is ages 30 to 50 are like the sad low point in most people's lives when it comes to friendship. You know, like those are times when a lot of people see their caregiving responsibilities and their professional demands just really increase, and they feel like friendship is the thing that they can let go of. And I think what we're really trying to say is that, you know, friendship is a relationship that can be sustaining as well as something that requires time. And, you know, really living in community with friends can help you figure out these other areas of life, not detract from them. And we are all for finding ways to maintain a friendship, even through periods where one or both friends are feeling like they maybe don't have the time or the energy for it.
Aminacho, can you tell us a little bit about your friendship origin story between the two of you?
We met 11 years ago in Washington, D.C. We were introduced by a mutual friend who very intentionally set us up on a friend date. We went to watch television at her house. It was a time where, you had to show up at someone's house to watch cable. And, you know, and really since that day, we have been friends.
And can you talk about sort of the friendship courtship idea? I mean, we have kind of, I mean, they're complicated, but we have rules and systems for building a romantic relationship. As a grown up, I don't know, it feels a little silly to come up to somebody and say, "Will you be my friend?" How can we kind of cultivate that with people, even if we don't know, like you two seem to, that this is the right one to be my friend?
That there's a feeling that by the time we get to adulthood, we're supposed to have our friends locked in, and somehow saying to someone, "Hey, I really want to be your friend," can feel like an admission of, like, I don't know, that you're not cool or that you don't have it all together or something like that. It can really require some vulnerability to do that. But you know, one thing that's been true for both of us and many people we've talked to is that it's not like you get to a certain age and all your friends are just locked in and they're going to, you know, be that way forever. You know, as life changes, circumstances around friendship change too. And we all are going to need to make new friends in adulthood. And you're right that saying explicitly, "Hey, do you want to be friends?" is an important part of that as we are all busy and as we all have to not make the assumption that everyone else has got their friends in order and we are the weird ones. Everyone needs friends.
We're talking to Anne Friedman and Aminatou Sow. They are the co-authors of the book, Big Friendship, How We Keep Each Other Close. They are longtime friends themselves. Aminatou, the book focuses a lot on the upsides of you and Anne's friendships over the years. I'm going to be mean and go to the down part that you share in the book. Can you tell us how you ended up in kind of a weaker moment in your friendship and how you put the effort into it to build it back up?
That's not being mean at all. And we really wish more people would actually talk about the complications of friendship. It's completely normal in a romantic relationship or even in a family situation to acknowledge that, you know, it's hard. It's hard to be a parent. It's hard to be a spouse. It's also very hard to be a friend. And we would love to make that normal. You know, in romantic relationships, there is this shorthand of "we grew apart" that everybody immediately understands what that means. But in friendship, the same thing is possible. There is not like a big, you know, dramatic incident that happened with us where we can just easily point a finger to someone. But over a couple of years, we just started missing each other. And we are two people who work together. So when, you know, when we are really straining to find things to talk about, we know that something is wrong there. And for us, that process ended up sending us to therapy because we really needed to find a way to repair our relationship.
And that in some ways, it sounds like, wow, that's bad. Your friendship got to a point where you needed therapy. On the other hand, Anne, you valued your friendship enough, the two of you, to make that kind of effort. Why was it so important to both of you?
That's a great question. And I think that our perspective on that has maybe changed over time. You know, originally, we both just wanted to figure out what was going on and gain a sense of peace with what had formerly been a really happy, supportive part of each of our lives that just wasn't that anymore. And I think that as we made this decision to do this, frankly, kind of weird and dramatic thing and go to therapy together as friends, we really realized how committed we were to each other and to finding a way to continue to be close. And I think that, you know, we have both learned a lot about ourselves individually through this process as well. And I think that is one thing that has always made us feel great about the investment. Like, yes, our friendship survived, but also just the amount of self-knowledge we each gained has been huge and transformative.
When you two started this podcast and started writing the book, I imagine you didn't know that we would all be sheltering at home and having a hard time socializing, but you two have done the long distance friendship thing. I'm hoping you have some great advice. Let's start with you, Aminatou, on keeping up friendships when you just can't get together in person.
Oh man, we are not experts. And we, you know, if you read one page of our book, you will understand that we are messy people who just love each other. And, you know, we are just trying to hang on too. I think that you're right. In this relationship, we have been long distance for a really long time. So we have some, you know, very built-in ways of how to stay in touch. But the longer the pandemic goes, the harder that becomes even for two people like us who are seasoned at it. I would say that if there's any advice to give here, the thing that I would say to people is to really just tell each other what you're anxious about. So much of friendship conflict or friendship anxiety is something that only ever plays out in one person's head. And I think that just saying to your friend, hey, I am really stressed out. You are important to me. I don't know how we do this. How can we both solve this together? Goes so much further than just, being miserable about it but on your own.
And Anne, I know people are doing Zoom conversations or other kinds of video chats. Do you have advice on kind of friendship maintenance, you know, in the text form as we're keeping an eye on each other's Facebook or whatever feeds?
Yeah, I think one thing that's become really clear to us is that keeping an eye on someone's feed is really not the same thing as checking in with them directly. You know, it can feel like we know the details of someone's life when we read what they're posting and see what they're posting on the internet. But the truth is, we only have a little piece of the story. The internet makes it really hard to share things that are difficult or complicated or, you know, still unfolding, things that are not like a very definitive event. And that's the stuff that really makes up a close friendship, staying in touch about those daily struggles. And so, you know, we have both been through periods of various friendships where we are watching the other person online more than connecting with them directly. And it's true in this age when people are not together in person in a way they once were, it becomes all the more important to check on them and say, hey, I'm seeing this on your Facebook. Is that the whole story? Just ask about it directly.
Let's bring on a caller. Leticia is with us in Libertyville, Illinois. Leticia, hi.
Hi. Well, it really struck a chord to me with me when she mentioned about vulnerability. I'm 60 years old, and as I get older, friendships do come and go. And I hate to say it, but, you know, people pass on, people move away, they retire, and you lose that connection. So I recently made a new friend about 3 years ago. I was out walking in a forest preserve one morning, and I met a lovely young woman around my age, and she was looking at something in the lake, and I stopped and asked her what she was looking at, and we got to chatting and chatted for about 15-20 minutes, and then I went home, and I really kept thinking about how much we clicked and how much we had in common. We both loved books, and we had older children. I had recently retired. She was thinking of retiring, and what really was hard for me, but I knew where she worked because she'd mentioned it. And so I just sent her an email at her work. I thought, gosh, this is kind of stalkerish. But I told her, I said, I really enjoyed our conversation. I know you like to walk in the morning. That's how we met. Would you consider me as a walking buddy occasionally? And she reached out immediately and said, yeah. And we have walked together two or three times a week since. With COVID right now, she's sort of stuck visiting family in Washington State. I really miss her, but we do check in. I just sent her a book, from an author that we both like. And as we age, I just think it's so important to keep striving for maintaining friendships and making new friendships because, you know, it's really easy to become isolated as we get older.
Leticia, thank you so much for sharing that story. I mean, I don't know if I could do that, if I could make that first move with this person who, you know, 20 minutes ago was a stranger.
Rob,
you have to. This story is so beautiful.
Yeah, I love the
story. I'm so moved. I'm so moved right now because here's the thing. Everyone wants to be pursued. It's just hard to be the one that initiates the thing, you know, but everyone wants to be invited. And I think that if you are someone who wants to have friends, you are going to have to do the inviting. And I love this story so much. It's so, so lovely.
Thank you so much for that call. We're talking to Aminatou Sow and Anne Friedman, co-authors of the book Big Friendship, How We Keep Each Other Close. They also host the podcast Call Your Girlfriend. And we want to hear from you. Do you have an important friendship in your life? What does it give you? What does it teach you? Why is it important? Do you think our society needs to place more value on friendships? If you had to work through a tough time in a friendship yourself, tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Aminatou Sow and Anne Friedman, who co-wrote a book about the deep challenges and benefits of friendship. Their book is called Big Friendship, How We Keep Each Other Close. They co-host the podcast Call Your Girlfriend. And we want to hear from you. Tell us about your own valuable friendships. What is your friendship origin story? What have your friendships taught you? What do you think makes for a good, long-lasting relationship with a friend? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know. We heard from Nicole on Facebook. She shared her friendship origin story. She says, when we were in fourth grade, she was working on a report on the computer, and I tripped over the power cord. Guess who hadn't saved their work? She was so mad at me. But then 2 years later, in sixth grade, we became inseparable, continued to be so 6 years through school, and are still BFFs today. We've been through everything together. Support and encouragement are priceless, and I look forward to the next 25 years of growth with her. And I want to key in on that support and encouragement idea, because the two of you have talked even before the book about the shine theory and the value of boosting your friends, not just being there for them, but actually boosting them. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, it is exactly what this listener is describing. It's about showing up for your friend in the same way that you show up for yourself in your own life, your own career, your own goals. It's rooted in a phrase we have often said to each other, which is, I don't shine if you don't shine. And it's become, a shorthand for collaborating with someone rather than competing against them or feeling jealous of them, and really making an investment in them being their best self as something that's, you know, good for you, good for the friendship, good for everyone.
Let's go back to our callers now. Peter is with us in Madison. Peter, hello.
Hello. How are you?
Good. What do you want to bring up, Peter?
Well, I am in my 60s, and when I was in my 20s in college, someone from the church I attended said, you should have friends that are older than you and younger than you, not just friends your own age. And I've tried to follow that advice, and I think it is very good advice, because you just get such a much better perspective on the world if you're not just with people of your own age group, where you're all going through the same thing at the same time, because you can learn from younger people, new ideas. For example, I'm generalizing, but, you know, what are some coming trends, et cetera? And also from the old people who are older than you, you know, what are some things that maybe you should plan for that maybe your group isn't thinking about? So just having people from different age groups.
I like it, Peter. I mean, what do you think? And that can be easier said than done sometimes, but the value of getting friends from different generations.
Oh, I mean, I think this advice is spot on, you know, especially when you think about just the transformative potential of friendship. And the caller is absolutely right. Having people in your life who are older and younger opens you up to all kinds of experiences and all kinds of knowledge. I think that we do not talk enough about intergenerational friendship, and it's very important.
Thanks for that call. We heard from Anna in Richland Center, who says people have a tendency to take their friends for granted. Don't do that, Anna says. She said she lost a dear friend 10 years ago and misses her badly. And that reminds me, you talk about, I think, research in the book that says, you know, one of the greatest regrets people have at the end of their days is exactly what Anna said, losing touch with their friends.
Yeah, you know, we quote a nurse in Australia who has written about this at length. You know, she cares for people at the end of their lives. And, you know, one thing that she consistently hears is that people really regret not hanging on to their friendships through times in life when maybe they felt they didn't have the time, or, you know, through the kind of rough patch that we've described. And the truth is, you know, she has this line where she says, everyone misses their friends when they are dying. And like, wow, really, if you need a reason to stay in touch with people who care for you so deeply, like I can hardly think of a better one. You know, like we really want to be there for each other until the very end.
We're talking to the authors of the book, Big Friendship, How We Keep Each Other Close, Anne Friedman and Aminatou Sow. Talk about the value of friendship and the value of putting effort into maintaining friendships through your lives. I want to talk, before we run out of time, you spend a chapter on the issue of race. You two are from different backgrounds. As somebody looking in from the outside might say, oh, that's wonderful. Their friendship magically, you know, got around all the issues of race in this world. And you say, no, not really. I mean, Adu, can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, I mean, I am a Black person and Anne is white. You know, our friendship really is on like based on a share on some shared values that we have. But the truth is that, you know, race is always happening in the world, whether we are like whether in our friendship we are resolved about it or not. The world that we live in is largely racist. And so our approach is not to put our heads in the sand and say, oh, we have it figured out and nothing is happening here. But it really is to say we are two different people. And how do we account for the fact that things that happen in the world can also happen in our friendship? You know, we understand that a lot of people are new to this conversation about how, you know, racism is really shaping American society, but that is not true for everyone. And so I think that, you know, having a little bit of humility and also having an understanding that you cannot truly be intimate with people if you do not understand their lived experience, you know, that should really force everyone to be having these conversations all the time. And, you know, and it's not just people in interracial friendships that should be talking about race. People in every kind of friendship configuration should be talking about race because it, you know, racism is a dynamic that affects everyone in the country.
And can you talk about, you know, how to bring up a difficult issue between friends, whether it's race or politics or, you know, somebody's taken offense at something in an interpersonal relationship. How do you do that? You know, bring up that important thing without damaging the friendship.
Well, I can tell you where we have gotten in trouble on this front is that we have often waited a really long time to say something. You know I in particular am guilty of saying like, okay, that didn't feel great, but I am just going to wait and figure out till I have the exact right thing to say to my friend about this. And what tends to happen then is it festers and it does end up affecting the friendship, even if you're not talking about it. And, you know, I do think being able to say, hey, I know we share these core values and yet this thing happened that really, made me feel hurt or made me feel like we're not on the same page or, you know, made me question something that I had previously held true about our friendship. Being able to just say like, oof, that didn't feel good in real time is something that I really wish that I had been better at in both this friendship and other friendships of mine.
Just have a few moments left. Aminatou, can you give a pep talk to people to maybe take a minute today to try to reconnect with that friend they've fizzled with, but they didn't want to?
Oh, I need that pep talk myself. You know, I think that really asking yourself, like, what is the worst thing that can happen if you have a really earnest conversation with someone? And the truth is that nothing bad will happen, you know, and probably you will learn a little bit about yourself and you will come away with that experience with some empathy. I think that, you know, we are living in a time that is just really hard right now. We're in a once in a lifetime global pandemic. Everything is falling apart. And if the people that matter to you are not front and center, you know, in your mind right now, I don't know what to say about that. But I think that if they are really trying to come to a place where you give people the benefit of the doubt and you show them that you care about them and that you love them the same way that you would like for someone to show you that they love you and care about you is so important right now. So reach out to your friends and tell them that.
And we'll have to leave it there. Thanks to Aminatou Sow and Anne Friedman. They co-host the podcast Call Your Girlfriend. We talked to them about their new book, Big Friendship, How We Keep Each Other Close. Have you checked out WPR.org lately? You can listen to past shows, read both fun and informative digital articles, plus get the latest from the WPR News Department. Check it out at WPR.org. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then noted travel writer Rick Steves has probably had to cancel more travel this year than many of us put together. He joins us to share what he's learned about noticing and appreciating our own neighborhoods and towns as a first-time visitor might. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.